Ladies and gentlemen, we're so protected in this country that all of you there should feel pretty safe sitting in this room. The laws and the machinery of government protect you from bodily harm, protect your property from being stolen, your food from being spoiled, your environment from being polluted, your children from growing up uneducated, your religion from being established by government, and on and on. And in spite of all this protection, much of which we will all agree is essential, all is not well with our quality of life, and many of us are asking, who will protect us from the protectors? We must ask some fundamental questions about regulation. Is it necessary at all? Some things are not regulatable. For example, try regulating your wife if you're a husband. And if regulation is necessary, in an objective sense, how far should we go to be cost-effective? How far should we go to not destroy the object of the regulation? How far should we go so that the regulation remains a means to accomplish specific results which are first achievable and which are being achieved by the regulation and are not instruments of abuse and ends in of themselves? To express these concerns, we have three distinguished gentlemen. The first was a graduate of the City College of New York and received his MA from Columbia University, a PhD in economics from Princeton. He's the author of many publications. He now holds the Mallinckrodt Distinguished University Professorship at Washington University. He has been formerly Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy, and he is now Director of the Center for the Study of American Business at Washington University, St. Louis, Murray Weidenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen. I think there's a very special reason why we ought to focus on government regulation this afternoon. And that, I think, is because that's the soft spot. What I mean by that is, as you may have heard, there's a tremendous encroachment on the part of government over the private sector. But I find that most of the standard defenses of the free enterprise system, well, very frankly, they're so self-serving, they just don't carry much weight. In fact, what that does is put you on the defensive. Personally, I rather take the offensive, and I find that the soft spot, perhaps the Achilles heel of expanding government, is the nonsense, and I use that term advisedly, is the nonsense which accounts for a major share of the expansion of government regulation of business. And by educating the public as to the ridiculous, and I'll cite chapter and verse so that when I say ridiculous, it's not an overstatement, as to the ridiculous nature of so much of the increasing government regulation of business, I think we can start to turn the tide. I think you have to be a patient optimist, very frankly. It'll take a lot of doing. But I do think that the congressional elimination of the interlock system on the passenger automobiles is a striking case in point, where literally the public did rise up and successfully override an excessive amount of government regulation of business. But I think we need to know our subject matter before we really attack it. And let me make one, what I think is a very basic point. The massive wave of government regulation of business that is underway is not just more of the same. In very large measure, it's a new departure. But the fact that there is a massive wave, I think, is not subject to argument. In preparing my paper, I took the May 14th issue of the Wall Street Journal. That was that day's paper. And all I did was to cut out the articles in that one issue of the journal that dealt with government control over business. They came to 19 articles. In fact, when I picked up what was left of the paper, it looked like I was cutting paper dolls because only pretty much the advertisements were left. Let me read to you just the headlines of some of those articles to indicate both the scope and the intensity of government regulation. Remember, just one day, one issue of the Wall Street Journal. More regulation by government gets 56% backing in poll. DuPont Christiana to defend merger plan in court. U.S. seem ready to require Firestone to begin largest tire recall on record. Searle's low-calorie sweetener delayed again for a health review. Bill to make some banks give loan data to government clears House committee. U.S. official urges SEC to slow loan loss rule. Phase out of controls on oil prices voted by House sub-panel. Senate votes funds for Amtrak. Honduran panel verifies bribe by United Brands. Better planning of less. Thiokol gets ordered to run Army facility. AT&T agrees to boost efforts on hiring of women and minorities. EPA says automakers haven't tried to meet 78 standard on nitrogen oxide. Ralston Perina says judge denies order on tuna ads. Consumer unit debate is halted by Senate 71-27. SEC to sue Ashland for not disclosing payments made to gain oil concessions. Movable's advocacy ads lead a growing trend, draw praise, criticism. Futures panel sets more guidelines to regulate trades. And then the final one, Minnesota Mining annual meeting is surprisingly tame. Management, this is all a headline. Management criticism is little despite Irving's decline and illegal political gifts. End quotation. Yet, as I said, this new wave of government regulation is not merely an intensification of existing activities. It is a new departure. Let us recall that there is a traditional theory of government regulation of business, which is still in very much general use. It's based on the model of the old Interstate Commerce Commission. Under that approach, you're supposed to set, or you wind up setting up a federal commission to regulate a specific industry with a concern to promote the well-being of that industry. Often the public or consumer interest is viewed as subordinate or may even be ignored. In some cases, because of the expertise possessed by the industry or its job enticements, the regulatory commission is supposed to become a captive of the industry which it regulates. At least this, we must recognize, is the popularly held view of the federal regulatory process. And the ICC isn't the only example. We've got the CAB, the FCC, the FPC, so forth. Surely that type of regulation continues. But I think it's critical to understand that the new wave of government regulation over the past 10 years, the new agencies that Congress has been and is continuing to set up, follow a fundamentally different pattern. And if we continue to evaluate government regulation using the archaic ICC model, we're going to be led to undesirable public policy. Let's understand the new federal regulatory agencies. What's tricky about them is they're simultaneously both broader and narrower than the ICC type of agency. And it's that anomaly that lies at the heart of the problem. I'm talking about EPA, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Consumer Product Safety Commission, Federal Energy Administration, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. For one thing, it's broader. Each of these are broader because they're not limited to a single industry. Their jurisdiction extends to every part of the private sector. And it's that far-ranging characteristic that makes it impractical for any single industry to dominate them. Who's going to capture the EEOC? What industry is going to capture OSHA or would even want to? Yet, in comparison to the old industry, old kind of regulation, The new federal regulators operate in a much narrower sphere. That is, they're not concerned with the total operations of an industry or of a company, but only with a narrow segment of operations that falls under their jurisdiction. This limitation prevents the regulatory agency from developing a concern, certainly from developing too close a concern, with the overall well-being of any company or industry. In fact, in practice, it results in the total lack of concern over the effects of their actions on a total company or a total industry. In fact, if there's any special interest that can dominate such an industry, it's the one that's preoccupied with its specific task. I mean the consumerists, the ecologists, the women's groups, the civil rights advocates, the unions, no particular industry. Little attention is given by the new breed of regulators to the basic mission of industry to provide goods and services to the public, the basic economic mission of American industry. They also ignore fundamental but cross-cutting concerns, productivity, economic growth, employment, cost to the consumer, and that may be their Achilles heel. I'll get to that. Effects on overall living standards, and of course the inflationary impacts of the regulation. At times, the process of this new breed of regulators that just looks at one sliver of a company's operations reminds me of that dentist who looks at his patient as merely two rows of teeth surrounded by a mass of miscellaneous material. The result, I'm afraid, of the new approach to government regulation is just the reverse of the traditional situation. Rather than being dominated by a given industry, the new type of federal regulatory activity utilizes the resources of the industry to achieve its own objectives. They ignore the needs of the industry, the companies they regulate, in terms of the basic economic mission to produce goods and services. In fact, my personal study of the new regulatory agencies reveals many negative aspects on their part of very considerable importance. But to begin with, we must recognize that it's damn difficult to criticize their mission. You have to possess literally the personality of Scrooge to quarrel with their intent. You know, are you against safer working conditions? Do you want unsafe products for the consumer? Don't you want to eliminate job discrimination? Do you want to pollute the environment? Of course, to some degree, some of these agencies have helped in these worthy objectives. But, ladies and gentlemen, no realistic evaluation of the actual practice of these government regulatory agencies fits the notion of benign, wise officials making sensible decisions in the society's interests. Instead, if we really look at it, we find waste, bias, stupidity, conflicts among the regulators because of the proliferation of regulation, and worst of all, arbitrary and uncontrolled power. These are not idle statements. I will cite chapter and verse to support them. Purchases of new cars in the United States last year paid over $3 billion extra for the equipment needed to meet federal requirements. Now, yes, the Congress eliminated the requirement for the interlock system, but not until after 40% of the owners who paid for those annoying contraptions also paid to disconnect them. You don't have to be much of an economist to figure out what the benefit-cost analysis is of the situation where you pay to install the interlock system and you pay to disconnect it. It's all cost. There's no benefit. Unfortunately, the notion of the government adding to the cost of private production is continuing. The agencies are proliferating. As pointed out by earlier speakers, it's a major growth industry. But I want to update it. I was flattered when they quoted some of my data, which I published earlier this year, about, you know, $2 billion a year for the cost of regulation and 60,000 regulators. Well, in preparing the paper for this conference, I went to the fiscal 76 budget to get the latest data, $2 billion is out of date. We're now at $3 billion a year. And the regulatory workforce of the federal government is in excess of 74,000. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. These are big tips, to be sure. But the real cost of the 74,000 regulators is the cost they impose on the private production of goods and services. One clearly measurable cost is the growing paperwork burden that they impose on business firms. And that is growing. That is really a growth industry. Between 1967 and 1974, the reporting burden on American industry increased by 50%. Individuals and business firms spend over 130 million man-hours a year just filling out federal forms. In fact, the last time they took inventory, they found there was 5,146 different government forms. Moreover, there's a great lack of understanding on the part of the regulators of those they regulate. One of the congressional hearings tells you about one small businessman who attended a federal meeting on the paperwork burden. He was, of course, explaining how difficult it was for him to manage his business and fill out the forms. Of course, they told him, don't worry about it. Your staff can complete the forms. His answer was precious. Quote, when I attend this meeting, the staff is right here. It's me. End quote. Let me give you a few examples. One small radio station, 5,000 watt, spent over $26 just to mail the FCC its renewal application, and that was before the last postal rate increase. One Oregon TV station weighed its application renewal. It weighed over 45 pounds. At the other end of the spectrum, one large company uses 125 file drawers just to meet the federal reporting requirements in the personnel area. In fact, they say that they could eliminate one-third of the personnel staff if there weren't government reporting requirements. Sheer unproductive overhead. Another hidden cost of government regulation is reduced rate of technological innovation. On the average, the introduction of safe, effective drugs is delayed 4 years in the United States. Compare the U.S. and the U.K., which doesn't have as restrictive a drug law. What happens there benefits the patient, benefits the consumer, because the safe, effective drugs just are available sooner. Of course, a lot of these costs arise because of the attitude of the regulators. Let me quote a member, not a staff, a member of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Quote, when it involves a product that is unsafe, I don't care how much it costs the company to correct the problem. End quote. Instantly, you can't fault the commission for not putting its money, yours and mine, where its big mouth is. Because in one recent case in St. Louis, where a company hadn't pasted all the offense was they hadn't pasted a label on the bottle. The label was supposed to have the correct officialese. It's a mouthful. Cannot be made non-poisonous. What was the Consumer Product Safety Commission's answer? Well, the obvious thing is tell them to paste a new label on it. No. Pour all the contents down the drain, destroy it, and make a new batch with the right label. You know, one result of this tremendous burst of regulation is the opportunity, and they take advantage of it, for the bureaucrats to indulge in all sorts of exercises in trivia, as I said, also pure nonsense. Take the small businessman who has to deal with OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Here are some of the kinds of questions that he has to face that are in the OSHA rules and regulations. What size to establish for toilet partitions? How big is a hole? It depends where it is, by the way. When is a roof a floor? What color do you paint various parts of the building? And my favorite, how frequently are spittoons to be cleaned? Lethal hazards we're talking about. In fact, if you ever want to really get a feel as to the stuff and nonsense, read the definitions in the OSHA regulations. I'll give you just one as a starter. Exit. That's an easy one because I checked my dictionary, and an exit is, quote, a passage or way out, quote. Not for OSHA. This is a real challenge to finding an exit. To them, an exit is, quote, that portion of a means of egress which is separated from all other spaces of the building or structure by construction or equipment to provide a protected way of travel to the exit discharge. You're not finished yet, because obviously you have to find out what is a means of egress and what is an exit discharge. Exit discharge is the easy part. That's that portion of a means of egress between the termination of an exit and the public way. Means of egress, now we're getting there. A continuous and unobstructed way of exit travel. Notice an exit is an exit is an exit. And means of egress is a continuous and unobstructed way of exit travel from any point in the building to a public way and consists of three separate parts. The way of exit access, the exit. We start off defining exit, remember. And the way of exit discharge. A means of egress comprises the vertical and horizontal ways of travel. They're taking it in the arm, I guess. And shall include intervening room spaces, doorways, hallways, corridors, passageways, balconies, horizontal exits, courts, yards, and you guessed it, exits. But that's an easy one. Try ladder. I won't. I'll run out of time. You have to cope with three renditions of the identical tedious set of definitions plus one trigonometric function. If you think I'm having a rough time, let me quote you the chairman of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. That's the official agency created to hear appeals from OSHA inspectors. After reviewing one OSHA standard, here's what the chairman of this review commission said. Quote, what do you think it tells us to do? I have no idea. I don't think OSHA could tell you either before an inspection, citation, complaint, hearing, and post-hearing brief. I submit there isn't a person on earth who can be certain he's in full compliance with the requirements of this standard at any particular point of time. Before I leave OSHA, just one other point. If a small businessman or woman invites OSHA to inspect them to see, well, what am I doing wrong? They have to, if they find anything wrong, they have to slap a fine on them. Well, that discourages voluntary inspections. So there's a way out that one of the regional offices of OSHA have come up with. They said, take extensive photographs of your premises and mail it in to OSHA, so we can inspect them in our offices, encircle what's wrong, and send it back to you. Because after all, if we don't actually see the illegal condition with our naked eye, we can't fine you. You know, they've totally lost sight of the objective, which supposedly is a safer working environment. It's how to do it by the numbers. But, you know, OSHA doesn't have a monopoly on this nonsense. Let me give you the proposed guidelines on employee selection procedures. That's testing. They were drafted by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Coordinating Council to make sure that there's no discrimination in tests on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, in both the public or private sectors. Now, this is a draft that they're still debating, and you can see why they're debating. Just read the regulation, or try to read the regulation. Let me quote one piece which is not out of context. This is how the whole thing reads. A selection procedure has, and again, picture you're a medium-sized business that tries to understand this. A selection procedure is criterion-related validity for the purpose of these guidelines when the relationship between performance on the procedure and performance on at least one relevant criterion measure is statistically significant at the 0.05 level of significance. If the relationship between the selection procedure and the criterion measure is significant but nonlinear, the score distribution should be studied to determine if there are sections of the regression curve with zero or near zero slope where scores do not reliably predict different levels of job performance. Quote, this isn't funny, it's serious, because if they ever do go ahead with this, the result will not be better testing, the result will be a return to the far more bias-prone and subjective oral interview. They know not what they do. If you still think that the government regulators are wise and judicious, let me give you the example of the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. That's an HEW. They do the research to develop the safety standards. Well, last year they signed an agreement with the, and catch this, with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, that bastion of research, under which the official federal study of safety and health hazards in the clothing industry is being conducted by a union employee paid for by the union. In reporting this odd arrangement, OSHA noted the union will help obtain the cooperation of plant managers. Just contemplate the reaction of management to an investigation of its premises by its union in behalf of the government. Let me turn to the subject of the conflict among regulators. In some cases, the rules of the same agency work at cross purposes. You know, think about the OSHA requirement to have backup alarms on construction vehicles and also to have earmuffs so the noise on construction sites, I really have quite a few others here, but I gather I'm running out of time. But my favorite, perhaps, is the separate but equal toilet facilities. It seems OSHA here was the good guy. They understand that women, for well-known biological reasons, need special lounges. But the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission couldn't resist getting into this vital area of government business relations, and they require that male toilet and lounge facilities, although separate, must be equal to those provided for women. My only conclusion is that regulation like justice must be blind. But the most serious problem here isn't the stuff of nonsense, but the raw arbitrary power. Let me again quote a member of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Anytime the consumer safety is threatened, we're going to go for the company's throat. That's not an overblown metaphor. Take the Marlin toy products. They literally forced that company out of the toy business through a clerical error. By mistake, they put their products on the ban list, and they refused to take them off the ban list. Because, well, as they put it, we're not about to recall 250,000 lists just to take one or two toys off. Remember, that's the commission that specializes in telling a company to recall all of their products if there may be a defect. And it wouldn't recall its own product when there sure was a defect. But I don't mean to attack all forms of government regulation, to answer the chairman's opening point. Unless you're an anarchist, you do believe that the government should set the rules for the society. But there are serious questions as to what rules to set. How detailed should they be? How should they be administered? We've just been oblivious of the costs, of the side effects. In effect, the new wave of government regulation is based on that totalitarian principle, the end justifies the means. You know, consumer product safety at all costs. Environmental cleanup at all costs. What do we do about it? I think there is something very specific that we can do about it, and we can take a leaf out of the environmentalist's own handbook. You know, before you burp, you got to file an environmental impact statement these days. And sure enough, it's hard to construct anything now. You may be delayed years. Okay? How about requiring that before the environmental regulators can issue new regulation, they have to develop an economic impact statement. I tried this out on some people in Washington, and their answer was, oh my goodness, they won't be able to issue new regulations for several years. I could only smile. But I'm serious. For all of these, product safety, job health, equal employment, energy, require them to analyze the impact on the society, I think, you know, as an economist, is a very simple way of looking at it. You carry government regulation just up to the point, no further, where the benefits equal or barely exceed the cost. And you stop right there. Unfortunately, we haven't. And the result is overregulation. Why? Because we're oblivious. We, meaning they, are oblivious of the cost. And I'm serious. If we can truly get them to understand that what they're doing isn't just anti-business, it's anti-consumer, because it's the consumer who ultimately winds up paying for the more costly, the more inefficient, the more wasteful means of production mandated by government. That's what I refer to as the ultimate Achilles heel of government regulation. And let me end with the plea that what we really need is a major economic education program to explain to the public, the media, and certainly to consumers, that there's two sides to this government regulation coin. It's not all just benefit. A great deal of it is cost. And increasingly, it's the costs that are exceeding the benefits. And the result is to exacerbate the inflationary pressures that are besetting our society. That's why I said at the beginning, I'm a patient optimist, because I do think as we can get this vital economic point across to the public, we'll see a reduction in government regulation. And the reason I'm so confident is I've seen the tremendous howls of anguish on the part of the government regulators to the initial studies and reports we've issued, which clearly has put them on the defensive by showing that they are anti-consumers, because they increase the cost of the products that you and I have to buy. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wiedenbaum. The next speaker is living proof that all lawyers who make their living in dealing with regulation didn't create the system, nor do they all like it. He practiced law in Texas and later became a commissioner of the Federal Power Commission. He is now the special counsel for energy affairs to the governor of the state of Texas, Rush Moody.
After Murray's talk, it is necessary that I acknowledge the obvious. I stand before you as a self-confessed former bureaucrat. I really came here to help you plan your investment strategy. For if you can find a way to invest in federal regulation, buy. Some of you may not be fully familiar with the Washington alphabet. And if you cannot differentiate between the FPC and the FTC, between the FCC and the ICC, between OSHA and IRDA, and between the NRC and the CAB, it's time for you to do a little homework. To some of you, no doubt, these mysterious alphabetical agencies which proliferate in Washington perhaps perform arcane rituals that involve other people's businesses and other people's lives, but seldom your own. To many of you, I dare say the IRS and the SEC are relatively familiar and have meaning, but other alphabetical agencies may safely be ignored by all right-thinking businessmen who seek only to master their own destiny without governmental interference. If you suffer from these delusions, I invite you into the world of reality. Washington may well be Disneyland on the Potomac, but its fantasies now comprise the reality with which we all live and to which we must all adapt. Despite a growing awareness by some that our personal and economic freedoms are threatened by a government that has somehow become a they, divorced from we, the people, I believe that we enter an era of greater regulation than our society has heretofore known. and the prospects of pervasive federal regulation is a problem that must be recognized and understood and dealt with. Until the day arrives when the equivalent of a Boston Tea Party dramatizes public rejection of federal controls, government regulation will expand. I realize, of course, that you're not here to listen to an exposition of personal philosophy, but rather that you're here to seek some insight into what is happening and what perhaps may lie ahead. So let me, if I may, offer some thoughts on where regulation is trending. I speak on the basis of my own experience on the Federal Power Commission, my perception of the other agencies with which I dealt, and recent actions and non-actions which express the mood of Congress. As a first factual statement, I offer you this. Congress has taken no action in recent memory to lessen regulation. It has, however, done much to increase regulation. I think the acts that Murray mentioned, things like the National Environmental Policy Act, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission Act, the Emergency Petroleum Allocation Act, all illustrate the current trend of congressional thought. And not since the days of the New Deal have we seen so much new regulatory legislation compressed into such a brief time span. As a second factual statement, I offer this. Most regulated industries, after a period of adjustment, embrace economic regulation and fight for its retention. There is something in the economic regulatory process addictive to corporate management. Perhaps it is the lure of rates set on the basis of cost of service and fair rate of return. Perhaps it is the attraction of franchised operations which preclude competition. Perhaps it is the comfortable notion that stockholder and customer complaints can be passed off as arising from governmental decisions rather than from managerial decisions. Perhaps it's a combination of all of those, but whatever the reason, it seems that all too frequently, those who most resist any suggestion of deregulation are the regulated themselves. As a third factual statement, let me offer this. The consumer and environmental movements, currently, in my judgment, the most powerful political forces in our country, have embraced the notion that existing problems can best be solved through regulation. If the problem is one of inflation, we establish a cost of living council. If the problem is one of unsafe consumer goods, we create a consumer product safety commission. If the problem is one of environmental degradation, we create the Environmental Protection Agency and so forth. The list is almost endless. And valid as all of these concerns are, I question whether it is wise for the near uniform response of the organized lobby which purports to speak in Washington for concerned consumers and concerned environmentalists, for their answer always to be that of demanding an expansion of federal regulation. Finally, I suggest to you that those who administer regulation have a vested interest in its expansion. In Washington, where virtually the entire population depends for its livelihood on the existence of some form of governmental control, there is simply no incentive for anyone to work for the abolition of his job. Success is all too frequently gauged in terms of the size of the annual budget increase and by the number of people added to the bureau or to the agency. Since government workers have no product to sell, nor a profit margin to worry about, achievement is equated with the accumulation of power, and power is equated with control. Thus, I suggest that regulation will expand because everyone presently taking an active interest, the Congress, the regulated industries, the effective lobbyists, and the bureaucracy itself, have achieved a commonality of interest. And this current consensus will hold, in my judgment, until the costs of regulation, both in the sense of tax dollars spent for compliance and higher product prices caused by compliance, become so apparent and so onerous that we are forced to a fundamental reassessment of the role of regulation. What difference does it make if more regulation comes? Well, aside from the loss of personal and economic freedom that necessarily we're talking about, let me be specific about one particular area, the area where I have worked for the past 4 years. And the problem that I would discuss with you is the prospect of centralized allocation of energy and fuels. Let me give you some starting points, if I may, that stand out in my judgment. First of all, there is an emerging national consensus that a greater degree of dependence on OPEC fuels is intolerable, both from the standpoint of the freedom of our decision to make national choices and intolerable from the standpoint of cost. And so I think politics and sound policy will converge, and we will see some affirmative action to limit imports of crude oil and petroleum products. Now, here's plank number one of a national energy policy. We're going to do something to limit imports to near or at current levels. We may do it through tariff structure, as the President wishes. More likely, in my judgment, we will do it through the imposition of import quotas. So far, so good, except for proposition number two, which is domestic production of oil and natural gas have topped out. Domestic oil and gas production in 74 was below 1973 levels, and the decline trend will not be easily reversed. Now I add proposition number three. We have no present capacity to provide additional energy from any other energy source. Nuclear is so far behind schedule that it can provide no short-term relief, and if we don't get off our hands, it will provide no relief within the next decade. We're in no position to count on expanded coal usage. Add up the combined effects of legislative uncertainty, existing restrictions on usage, chronic shortages of equipment and transportation capability, and you reach but one conclusion, that coal is still a sleeping giant. New hydroelectric generation possibilities are virtually non-existent. And the exotic energy sources, such as fusion and solar and geothermal and shale, while they may come someday, they will not come soon enough to fill the energy gap that yawns before us now. So I suggest to you that if you place proposition number one, that is that oil and oil product imports will be limited, in juxtaposition with proposition number two, that domestic oil and gas production is declining, you can reach but one conclusion. We will experience an accelerating oil and gas shortage. Now add proposition number three, that the shortage cannot be met with other energy sources, and you reach the heart of my concern about expanded regulation. This country is in for a substantial reduction of the net amount of energy available to fuel this society of ours. To the extent that our conservation efforts can match the decline in deliverable oil and gas, so much the good. We'll be doing ourselves and our children immeasurable good to the extent that we eliminate waste and inefficiency. But what happens when we reach the point of efficient use of resources and there's still not enough to go around? I suggest to you that we will see federal allocation of fuels and energy. And following that, we'll see a recession that will make us refer to 1974, 1975 as the good old days. Why, do you ask, do I inveigh against government control of energy allocation and energy prices? My answer is twofold. The philosophy is wrong, and the procedure will be impossible. Philosophically, central control over energy is the equivalent of central control over the economy as a whole. If you let me, as a federal allocator, decide which region of this country receives energy and which does not, if you let me decide which industry receives energy and which does not, if you let me determine the price of energy to the users, you have made me the most powerful man in America. I can decide who prospers and who does not. I can decide who lives in comfort and who must live in discomfort. I can decide who stays in business and who is forced out of business. For energy is essential not only to industry and commerce, it is essential also to schools and to the professions and to the media. Energy is the common denominator in a modern industrialized society. And to me, central allocation power over energy and fuels is simply the grant of too much power. I do not trust the structures of government so completely that I'm willing to grant to it this power. Secondly, I cringe at the prospect of expanded controls over energy because I'm in a position to guarantee to you absolutely and unequivocally that the bureaucratic system is incapable of administering energy allocations and energy price controls in a responsive and responsible manner. The problem will not lie so much with the people who undertake the day-to-day task of energy allocation, for government service does still attract many capable people. No, the difficulty will come because of the complexities of energy production and consumption which defy simple solutions. A case in point is the FPC's rationing efforts with natural gas over the past 4 years. After innumerable litigated cases, after countless rulemakings and new regulations, after a dozen or so court opinions, I can safely say that no industrial gas consumer in this nation who is served by a pipeline over which the Commission has exercised allocation authority, not one of those industrial consumers can safely predict how much gas he will receive next year on a day-to-day basis. Now, the FPC didn't design it to be this way. Good Lord, we tried to make it simple and workable. But vagaries in supply, variations in temperatures, changing demands for gas for specific purposes, factors such as these conspire to create near total uncertainty. Perhaps others could have done better. Self-servingly, I don't think so. For when you take a difficult technical situation and stir in the ingredient of value judgments which are involved when you decide who gets energy and who does not, you have a recipe for regulatory failure. Thus, my own experience leads me to the belief that long-term energy allocations and price controls cannot be made to work. On a completely different level from the problem of bureaucratic impossibility and of administration, I suggest that chronic energy shortages will produce profound recessionary impacts also, and this is the other aspect of expanded regulation in the energy area that concerns me. Historically, we have enjoyed a year-by-year increase in energy consumption per capita. The trend is mirrored on virtually a one-to-one basis in income per capita and in GNP. What happens if we materially alter the energy input into this society? I suggest that the most probable effect will be a corresponding break in GNP and in income per capita. For if the flow of goods and services is interrupted, or if long-range planning for the output of goods and services is rendered so uncertain that expansion is deferred or canceled, we may expect recession. And surely, an interruption in industrial output must occur and planning must become speculative when the quantity of available energy becomes insufficient to meet national demand. Now, as in the fable of the 12 blind men who describe the whole of an elephant according to that particular part that is before him for examination, I realize full well that I've been patting only one part of the elephant for the past 4 years, and that my perception may be impaired, but I ask you to trust your own judgment in deciding whether or not adequate energy input is critical to jobs and to production and to housing, to construction and to the defense establishment and to every other segment of our society. I suggest, therefore, that the problem of energy exploration and development is not a province of interest to the oil companies alone or to the producing states alone, but that it is a national problem that can be resolved only through a community of understanding and to a community of effort. I want to suggest also that in this particular area of energy, we've now reached the point where the structure of regulation has demonstrably failed, and that we must now decide whether to respond to this failure with more regulation or with less regulation. If we do nothing, if we perpetuate the existing restraints on energy supply, we are actually deciding that we want vastly expanded regulation. For I promise you that a failure to expand domestic energy supply guarantees energy rationing. In my judgment, if we do nothing, we will be forced into rationing of all forms of energy within the next 18 months to 4 years. Our choice here is an affirmative one. We can and we should remove unworkable restrictions on new energy supply development. We invite energy rationing needlessly, for if Congress would act responsibly now without further delay on energy legislation, our period of national energy travail could be held to manageable lengths. But the unnecessary constrictions on energy supply must be removed. We have a situation today where energy suppliers or would-be suppliers find it more attractive to put their dollars into retail merchandising or into circuses than to reinvest in the business that they know best. I think it's an absurd situation, and indeed it's a national disgrace. We desperately need additional domestic energy, but we have, through government action and the threat of government action, made it practically impossible to form the capital necessary to fund the heightened levels of exploration and development that we must have. We're in this state for a number of reasons. Distrust of the energy industry, a belief that consumer protection inherently requires low-cost energy, a desire to protect the environment from further despoilation. Now, these are all legitimate areas of concern, but unfortunately, they operate in tandem in today's world to produce a factual circumstance where energy supply has become an unattractive investment and an undesirable line of economic activity. I suggest to you that continued price regulation in the oil and gas business is not an appropriate answer to concern about profit levels and consumer exploitation. These concerns should be addressed through profit controls as exercised through the tax structure. My personal conclusion is that the tendency towards greater regulation must be reversed, particularly in the energy area. And I think perhaps it is symptomatic of the sickness which grips us as a whole. When you follow the path of regulation so far that you reach a point where you have bound an industry or a segment of the economy into a straitjacket from which they cannot escape, you're always faced with the same choice that we now have in the energy area. Do we respond to the problem with more regulation, or do we respond to the problem by lifting regulation? It's an exceedingly difficult judgment for Congress to make, to lift regulatory controls, but it is a judgment which, in my firm belief, must be made and must be made soon. Regulation of oil and gas hasn't worked except to the extent that it's brought us less and less energy at higher and higher costs. And if we do not lift that regulation now, far greater regulation with its attendant risks is just around the corner. Thank you very much. Our next panelist and our last panelist of the day
may be better equipped in some ways to speak on the subject inflation than anyone who has come before him. When he left his native Italy in 1953 at the age of 17, he had experienced at first hand the effects of inflation on a modern state. He got his chemical engineering degree from New York University. He's authored and edited hundreds of articles in all aspects of industrial, chemical, and metallurgical operations. He is today the editor of Mining Engineering, the monthly journal of the Society of Mining Engineers. He's the research vice president of Mountain States Resources Corporation in Salt Lake City, and he's a director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education, a nonprofit organization in Greenwich, Connecticut. Eugene Guccione.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think it takes a person with my great perspicacity and profound acumen to recognize that after listening to all the speeches today and yesterday, all of you boys and girls are now in desperate need for some good news. And I have some good news about the topic of deregulation of industry. Even Johnny Weissmuller of the Senate, Mr. Ted Kennedy, said that he was in favor of getting rid of CAB because that pushes up the fares in airplanes. So that's good news. Not too much, but for what it's worth. Next good news, it's the good news about the energy crisis. So here it goes. Everything that could have possibly gone wrong seems to have already gone wrong. Now, I'm going to confine my remarks to the consequences of regulation on one industry, the coal industry. Dr. Neil Jacoby said that there is going to be a renaissance on coal. I don't remember whether he made an affirmative categorical statement. Perhaps he edged a little. Well, when it comes to coal companies, ladies and gentlemen, don't put your money on it and don't wait your breath on a renaissance of coal, and we'll find out why. Without oversimplifying the issue, the shortest explanation that anybody can give you about the energy crisis is that it was caused by a good intention and worsened by the use of force. The good intention was the notion that American consumers somehow should be entitled to cheap and abundant energy. Very laudable. The force took the form of price controls over natural gas, as the good Mr. Moody said. Now, government controls over natural gas had an enormous domino effect, a disastrous effect, on all competitors of natural gas, particularly coal. You see, it took the United States coal industry 55 years to increase domestic coal production from 568 million tons in 1920 to the current level of about 630 million tons. That's an 11% growth over 55 years. At this growth rate, it might take a few hundred years to double coal production. And yet, according to Federal Energy Administration planners, they say that coal production can and should be doubled by 1985. My personal opinion, based upon what government has done and is still doing to the coal industry, is that we'll be lucky if by 1985 the coal industry won't have been legislated and regulated out of existence. And here are the facts. In 1947, 28 years ago, U.S. domestic coal production was 630 million tons per year. Exactly the same as today. A few years later, in 1954, when the Supreme Court granted to the Federal Power Commission the authority to regulate natural gas even at the wellhead, coal suffered another competitive setback, and it was not a coincidence that in 1954 coal production went down to 390 million tons. After 1954, thanks to improved technology, the coal industry managed again to climb to a production level of about 600 million tons a day. when, in 1969, Congress, overreacting to the environmental hysteria and populist demagoguery, decreased the depletion allowance from 27.5% to 22%, thereby giving a blow to all of the energy industries, and then in very quick succession passed the Mine Health and Safety Act, out of which incidentally came out MESA and OSHA, along with the National Environmental Policy Act, and shortly after, in 1970, the Clean Air Act. Well, one immediate result of this kind of legislative orgy was that coal production immediately fell by 30%, that is, coal productivity per man fell by 30%, and domestic output decreased again to about 550 million tons in 1970. But you see, there were other consequences. Because the Mine Health and Safety Act closed a number of coal mines, a number of utilities that were using coal had a shortage of coal. Well, what do we do? Well, let's use residual oil. At this point, all hell broke loose in 1970 because, you see, there wasn't enough residual oil either. Why? Well, you see, just as the low prices of natural gas made it difficult for coal to compete, these same low prices also destroyed the price structure of residual oil, which up until 1970 and for a few years before had sold for less than the price of crude oil from which it was derived. As a result, petroleum companies drastically reduced their production of residual in favor of more jet fuel and in favor of more gasoline. Why more gasoline? Well, because they had to meet the greater demand for gasoline by automobiles. And why was that? Because of two great automobile designers, Senator Edmund Muskie and Mr. Ralph Nader, who installed certain gadgets in the car, these gadgets that converted the car into perambulating sulfuric acid plants, while at the same time decreasing gas mileage by 20%. So, this is how the Mine Health and Safety Act was one of the principal causes for the shortage of coal, of gasoline, and of residual oil. And this is how, by 1971, in the eastern seaboard, all the way from Maine to Florida, we became dependent on the Arab countries for more than 94% of the residual oil needed for heating and power generation. I'm now going to make a statement, and you may challenge me on it. I hope you do, because I'll rip you apart during the question and answer period. And the statement goes like this. The Arabs did not cause either our energy crisis or our monetary and economic crisis. We were doing a marvelous job of cutting our own throats long before the Arabs set up their cartel. You see, the Arab cartel was set up in October 1973, but the Mine Health and Safety Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Clean Air Act were set up 4 to 5 years before that. 5 years before the Arab cartel, Washington set up environmental standards based on what turned out invalid and grossly distorted evidence, and Congress also armed every environmental nut in the land with the weapons to destroy or at least delay new energy developments. Now, how did the environmentalists achieve that power? I highly recommend to you the May issue of Reason magazine. There's an excellent article in it by California energy consultant R.W. Johnson. Now, this is how Johnson explains how the environmentalists got the power they got. Quote, before Senator Jackson's passage or introduction of the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, ecologists could not, for example, sue the Department of the Interior to stop it from selling a federal land lease or granting permission to build a pipeline through federal lands. They could not allege damage to themselves, so they had no standing in court. However, after the National Environmental Policy Act was rushed through Congress on the tide of emotions and misinformation generated by the Santa Barbara oil spill, anybody, even a Russian agent, says Mr. Johnson, by posting a $100 bond could bring suit in federal court to stop the federal agency from granting operating licenses, leases, use of highways, or building permits. All the plaintiff has to allege is that the agency did not file, and here's the catchword, an adequate environmental impact statement, end quote. So, this is how Washington created the machinery that has delayed and even stopped entirely such energy-related projects as the Alaska Pipeline, offshore oil drilling, and the construction of new refineries and power plants. Now, who was behind the National Environmental Policy Act? That great energy expert and mining engineer, Senator Scoop Jackson, who got terribly peeved later on when we couldn't bring the Alaska pipeline, the oil from Alaska, into the United States. He says, well, what's holding it up? Well, you SOB, why don't you read your own bill? Anyway, while the National Environmental Policy Act has either prevented and or delayed new energy projects, there is another act. This one is by that famous automotive engineer, Edmund Muskie of Maine. The Clean Air Act has had a disastrous effect on existing developments. Now, don't take it from me, take it from Project Independence that came out from FAA. According to Project Independence, the Clean Air Act, unless repealed or amended, will cause, in the next 12 months, beginning next month in July, a 200 million ton coal deficit, the loss of 50,000 mining jobs, an additional $5.5 to $11 billion deficit in the balance of payments, plus atrocious land use problems for the disposal of solid waste from the sulfur dioxide scrubbers, and on top of everything else, a 25% in the cost of electricity. These disasters, what is Washington's reaction to all of this? More regulation, of course, more controls, more new agencies, more bills, more lawyers, more committees, more scientific illiterates asking the incompetents to do the unnecessary. Those guys in Washington, all of those demented dynamos are not solving the problem. They are the problem. Academicians and government consultants are not contributing to the solution either. Incidentally, by definition, a government consultant is the kind of fellow who knows 57 ways of making love but doesn't know any girls. One of them is Ralph Nader, and you know who Ralph Nader is that famous nuclear physicist who wants to put in a moratorium on the construction of nuclear power plants. Well, while I can understand why Ralph Nader and some little old lady in tennis shoes might be opposed to nuclear energy, after all, nuclear energy is a new thing, you might ask, what's all the fuss about ship mining? Why the opposition to the surface mining of coal? Now, here is another story that is worth telling it like it is, because even though I'm all for free press, and I think that a biased press, a stupid press, a prejudiced press is infinitely better than a government-controlled press, the fact remains that the reporting of the ship mining bill in most of the dailies has been spectacularly biased and ponderously superficial. So let's get on with the ship mining bill, because this kind of nonsense is going to come up again, if not when the 94th Congress, at least in the 95th Congress. By way of background, to set up the scenery, you should know that there are some native tribes in Africa who have the custom of beating the ground with clubs, uttering spine-chilling cries. Anthropologists call this a form of a primitive self-expression. Some of you Americans might call it golf. I call it Congress. 6 years ago, uttering spine-chilling cries, Congress began to draft the surface mining bill on the grounds that if you cannot reclaim the land, you cannot mine it. This was a good slogan. It made sense, but it also made the surface mining bill utterly unnecessary because the mining industry was already doing one hell of a good job in reclaiming. Of the 1.47 million acres used for surface coal mining from 1930 to 1971, 1 million acres, that's 66% for you engineers, had already been reclaimed by 1970. And in 1971 and in every year thereafter, coal people actually reclaimed more land than they mined each year. And finally, in spite of the grim picture that you keep hearing about wholesale devastation of the environment, the fact is that less than 0.2% of the total surface area of the country has ever been disturbed by any kind of surface mining, be it coal or hard rock. Half of that, and that's 0.16%, has already been reclaimed, and the rest is in the process of reclamation. So, you see, the ship mining bill had to be changed. It no longer stated that if you cannot reclaim the land, you cannot mine it. It was, instead, a 266-page engineering document written by people like Congressman Morris Udall of Arizona, who cannot even spell coal, telling you what coal to mine, where to mine it, and then how to reclaim. A majority of people in Congress voted for the bill, which only proves that any jackass can kick down the barn. Speaking of jackasses, and incidentally, this is where you find out why all of us put up with so much legislation. You will find quite a few jackasses in universities, in labor unions, and unfortunately in the mining industry. Some of the guys in the mining industry, for example, actually favored that stupid bill because they felt, and they still feel, paranoid about being called greedy, selfish capitalist, which is dumb. Look, nowadays, anything happens, we will be blamed for it. If we are able to make a profit, demagogues will accuse us of stealing from consumers. If we don't make a profit and must shut the mine down, the same demagogues will accuse us of creating unemployment. Anyway, various people in the industry said, instead of saying, well, it's a lousy bill, we are reclaiming, we are doing a good job, said, well, let's try to live with this bill. Let's sweeten it. And this is where that process of symbiosis between the regulators and the regulated acts up with a vengeance. Well, unfortunately, no legislation has ever been improved with the passage of time. The only one I can recall is prohibition. And to repeal that particular piece of idiocy took a constitutional amendment. What about the universities? Well, since the ship mining bill, you see, incorporated a sweetener granting $120 million of federal aid to mining schools, some professors were in favor of the bill. Sure, they said, we know it's a lousy bill, but look at the goodies we are getting. What about labor? Well, there are 9 major groups or locals in the United Mine Workers Union, 3 of which are Canadian and couldn't give a damn, and the other 6 are Americans and do care very much because their membership is predominantly from underground mining. So, UMW, the United Mine Workers Union, favor the bill because they figured if we succeed in stopping ship mining, then more coal has to be mined underground, and that means more money for us. But you see, there are other reasons why so many people were in favor of that lousy bill. And I'll give them to you in sequence, in the order of importance. In the first place, compared to underground mining, surface mining is much safer. It is 20 times less likely to result in the death of a miner. And yet, environmentalists are against ship mining. Now, I suspect that the reason for that is that they, among other things, are worried about overpopulation. So they figure, if we ban ship mining, more people will die underground, and that might be a small solution to the problem of overpopulation. Next, surface mining is more efficient. It recovers 80% of the coal. In the thick western seams here, the recovery rates can exceed 95%. In underground mines, you can only recover about half of the coal. You ask why? Well, you see, you have got to leave some of the coal in the pillars that hold up the roof. Otherwise, the roof will fall over your head with some rather unpleasant effects. So, you see, this is simple to understand, but I suppose it's too difficult for idiots and politicians to understand. Next, surface mining is more productive. In the same amount of time that it takes an underground miner to produce 1 ton of coal, a surface miner can produce 20 tons of coal, up to 20 tons. But again, you see, in the minds of politicians and idiots, and I use those words interchangeably, higher productivity is not a virtue, but a vice because, quote-unquote, it creates unemployment. That is the excuse. Now, get a load of this. I'm not exaggerating. When Anaconda, a few months ago, announced that they were going to close their underground mines in Butte, a congressional hearing was conducted to forestall this action by the company. During the hearing, Congressman Max Baucus of Montana said that Anaconda should stop trying to increase productivity by mechanization and put more men to work underground with hand shovels. Hand shovels. Well, my dear Congressman, why stop there? Think how many more people you could put underground to work with teaspoons. Well, of course, the cost of anything mined and produced in that fashion might be slightly astronomical, but then our noble humanitarian politicians have never been hindered by considerations of costs or facts. Next. Coal in the western states is clean, meaning it contains from a half to one-tenth the amount of sulfur present in eastern coal. Why, you ask, don't we mine more western coal? Because you boys and girls do not understand that if we were to mine and burn the low-sulfur western coal, that would be the end of the alleged air pollution crisis, or just about, and all those thousands of bureaucrats in the Environmental Protection Agency coal division would be out of a job. Now, you all know we want to keep our jobs. You see, a bureaucrat thrives on crisis. If no crisis exists, he will manufacture one in order to convince himself and others of his indispensability in protecting the public interest. Next. Ship mining in the western states would disturb much less land than ship mining in the east. How much less? Well, it's not 10% less, 20% less. It would be 90% less. And I'll give an example. In the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, if you want to produce 30 million tons of coal per year, all you need is 300 acres of land. If you want to ship mine, let's say, in a populous state like Illinois, which is a big coal state, to produce 30 million tons of coal, the same amount of coal, you need from 4,500 to 7,500 acres of land that you would disturb instead of a mere 300 as in the West. Next, if half of the anticipated increase in coal production by 1985 comes from the West, it will require the surface mining of only 130,000 acres of land. Now, put this in perspective. 130,000 acres of land ship mined would be a temporary use of land over the next 10 years and would be equivalent to less than the amount of land devoted to parking lots in 1 year. And yet, the surface mining bill granted to the surface tenant of the land on federally owned coal a veto power on whether or not the coal would be mined. The bill also placed a ceiling upon compensation. After all, we don't want windfall profits for those greedy ranchers. So it placed a ceiling on the compensation of the ranchers, thereby destroying whatever incentive the rancher might have to give you permission to mine the underground coal. So this alone would have effectively prevented the mining of most of our western coal. Finally, get a load of this. The cost of ship mine coal is less than half than the cost of underground mine coal. Why then don't we produce more surface mine coal, you ask? Now, you dummies, consider the following. Coal and uranium are the solution to our energy crisis. Any legislation that affects coal will also affect uranium. In the entire country, there is only one underground uranium mine in New Mexico. It belongs to Anaconda. All the others are surface mines. So, with legislation like the Mine Health and Safety Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, and some new version of the surface mining bill, the development of coal and uranium will be prevented. The energy crisis will remain. We will wind up with allocations and all those wonderful guys who fine-tuned us into stagflation will be administering and regulating and controlling, and they will keep their jobs, of course. Now, to give you an even bitchier example, The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare will be in business as long as it succeeds in keeping enough Americans sick, dumb, and poor. Now, the solution to the energy crisis is not going to come from Washington. If we have learned anything at all since yesterday, we have learned this, that asking Washington to help to correct a problem is like asking an arsonist to help you put out the fire. Throwing out the rascals and voting in a fresh batch of nitwits is not the answer either. The only solution to the energy crisis is in a massive program of deregulating and decontrolling industry. We may survive double-digit inflation, we may survive greater taxation, but unless we regain our freedom to produce, to create, to trade, the American economy will reach the terminal stage. We will solve the crisis, but government simply has to get out and stay out and perhaps learn something from the Swedish welfare people who have come to the recognition that if we are going to spend all of this money for welfare measures, well, at least we should not bind, gag, and castrate the producers. After all, if you want to rip off somebody, make sure that that somebody first makes what it is that you want to steal. You see, I believe in division of labor. I think that government should keep doing what it has always done best. And if you consider all the millions of Chinese citizens, Russian citizens, and German citizens who have been butchered deliberately by their own governments, and if you consider all of the inflations that we're in this century, then you come to the inescapable conclusion that government, of all human institutions, is the most overrated, except in the two areas, killing and stealing. So let's tell them, all right, let's have division of labor. You people, steal and kill. Put more taxes, debauch the currency. But at least, untie my hands so that I can produce and keep you bums alive. The energy crisis, ladies and gentlemen, the cause of that crisis is not geological, it is not technological, it is political. And if you and I are losing our wealth, the extent to which we are losing our wealth is the extent to which government has violated, curtailed, and infringed our freedom to explore, to develop, to grow, to produce, and to trade. That is the extent to which our wealth has been diminished and our supplies of fuels decreased. Thank you.
Could everybody hear that question? He says, as a businessman, he asks, in the event of OSHA coming in and practically putting him out of business, what is his solution?
It isn't easy. Some companies have been very effective, and I mean small companies, in getting their story to the public, which has lit such a fire under some of the regional offices of OSHA that they have on occasion backtracked. I know it takes a lot of guts. The reason I say that is every time I've spoken out or written on the subject of OSHA, I get a lot of written crank mail, and I get a lot of phone calls from businessmen who agree with me, none of whom have the intestinal fortitude to commit, or the gut, or maybe the foolhardy nature to commit their adverse views on OSHA into writing. But I think if you feel you have a legitimate gripe, there's the OSHA Review Commission, there's the courts, there's the press, there's your congressman, you got two senators. I think too many business people have just stood and taken it.
And nobody asks a question. If you work within the system, doesn't that encourage the system? But here's a question along that line for you, Dr. Wiedenbaum. Do you really believe that deregulation would entice business to accept responsibilities such as 1, safe working conditions, 2, controlled air and water pollution, 3, safe workable products, 4, adulteration of food products, And five, absorption of minorities into the economic system, just to wrap up the kind of mail that you say that you get.
Well, again, as I said in my presentation, unless you're an anarchist, you do believe in some government regulation. In other words, the government sets the rules for the society. So it's not an either-or. It's not, are you for or against safe working conditions? But I don't know why OSHA has to tell a company how often to clean its spittoons. That's not a lethal hazard. In other words, the whole plea I'm making is to that we need to economize on government controls. We need to understand they're costly, they're powerful, they have tremendous side effects. Like any tough medicine, you use it sparingly. That's the notion.
All right, now here's one for Mr. Moody and for Mr. Guccione. Do you agree with the administration policy of import tax on crude oil? And please elaborate and give your proposals on alternatives.
I'll take a crack at it first.
Okay, well, move the microphone in rather close, so I think it works better that way.
I do not fully agree with the administration proposal, because I think that the import tax levied on the whole barrel of crude means that you will have price increases across the full spectrum of usage that we put petroleum and petroleum products to. I'm personally of the view that that you should use the market mechanism as a means of inhibiting demand. But I think you have to select that part of the demand which you can influence with some degree of success. And in that sense, I think that the tax should be loaded on gasoline. I think that's a place where we stand a better chance of bringing about conservation. I think it's an area where we stand less risk of doing wide damage to the economy as a whole. And so just as a matter of personal choice, I think that it's appropriate to use the tax structure as a means of inhibiting demand, but I would use the tax consequences on the particular product where you should be able to reduce demand without putting the tax effect over into other areas.
Thank you. Mr. Guccione, do you have anything to add to that?
My answer to that is the price mechanism, the free market price mechanism, is the best allocator of resources. Now, I want to give you an example of the asininity of tariffs, of quotas, of taxation. Throughout the early 60s, when in this country we had so-called plentiful supplies of fossil fuels, Washington imposed import quotas and tariffs. Today, because we have a lack of fossil fuels, Washington is suggesting import quotas and tariffs. Make your own conclusions. Just deregulate natural gas, deregulate all oil. What's this nonsense about old oil and new oil? It all goes back to the Paleozoic age, as far as I'm concerned.
If the advent, if ever, of nuclear power, is the advent, if ever, of nuclear power likely to lead to the federalization of power, and can nuclear fuel be decentralized and transferred to 100% private ownership?
Well, if things keep going the way they are, there are a bunch of people in Congress who are talking about solving the energy crisis by eliminating the cause of the energy crisis, which is by nationalizing oil, coal, gas. And as far as nuclear energy is concerned, the R&D program is already nationalized anyway, and the demonstration plants are nationalized anyway. So what we will see is all of these industries run in the same superbly efficient and cost-conscious manner in which the railroads and the post office is run. I don't see any hope for nuclear energy to go anywhere, A, because I am not sure that the economics of nuclear power today are what they ought to be, and this is a very, very complex technical question that has to do with how much tailings you have left in your enrichment processing, going from uranium-238, which is your yellow cake that you mine and you concentrate, to uranium-235, which is only present to the extent of 0.7% in your raw ore. Well, that is an economic problem and a technical problem. But aside from that, conceivably, we might solve for good the energy crisis if and when we are able to have the commercialization of the Breeder reactor, which produces more fuel than it consumes. However, we are pursuing in this country a development policy based on a no-mistake philosophy, which is idiotic. And this is why, for instance, even a third-rate, broken-down country like England, Great Britain, is ahead of us in the Breeder reactor design. France already has one. Russia has one. With luck, we might have a commercial Breeder around 1990, but it's going to take an awful long time.
What about, and I hope I'm reading this correctly, what about decentralization of the monopoly on long-line grid network control with solar energy? Demonstrated devices and techniques presently exist, and government can grant tax benefits for installation. Would you please comment on that?
Well, I think solar energy has as many congressional proponents right now as any other of the so-called exotics. And I think we will see increasingly efforts by Congress to encourage development of solar energy. I think last week the House voted to give a tax benefit for anybody who installed solar equipment in their homes, for example. The premise of the question seemed to me that there was monopolistic control of a grid pattern in the United States, and I'm not sure that that's a valid premise. The grids that we do have that interconnect regions of the country, and the grid does not extend nationally at this time, the grid networks that we have are cooperatively owned by different private utilities serving particular regions. And, for example, the grid that serves Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, that part of the country, is owned by those privately owned utilities that operate in that region of the country, and the grid that serves California is owned by the companies that serve this part of the country. So I'm not sure I accept the premise that there is in existence a monopolistic control over the existing grid work.
All right, as long as the ball is in your court, and as long as you have been on both sides of that court, someone asks, as an attorney who has been a regulator, can you suggest methods by which business can defend itself against encroachment of regulatory bodies?
Well, I think in every instance that I know anything about, the problem basically is with the statutory structure. I differed with my colleagues on the FPC many times, and always I felt that there were things that we should get out of or be a little bit different in our pricing controls than they. But despite those differences, I had respect for them, and I think they were good men trying to do a job under a regulatory framework that simply wasn't designed for the job that we were trying to do. And what I'm saying is, and I know it's not a happy answer, the solution lies in the political process. We've got statutes that are on the books. The Natural Gas Act, for example, was passed in 1938 and has not been amended since then. Well, we've amended the U.S. Constitution, I think, 11 times during that period. We've got a bad set of statutes designed under one set of economic circumstances, and those circumstances no longer hold. And if we're going to fundamentally change the problem with regulation, then Congress has to be made aware of the need for that change. Unfortunately, I don't think they're aware of it presently, but I think as more people inform themselves and realize, as Dr. Wiedenbaum's talking about, the costs of regulation, then perhaps there's some hope.
Thank you. And again, we have run out of time before running out of energy or of questions or of provocative answers.